The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired back in May.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a keen chronicler of America's difficult and complicated story of race. In his two previously critically acclaimed books, Soul by Soul and River of Dark Dreams, the historian examined the 19th century slave markets and the growth of cotton, both of which expanded slavery greatly in the southern U.S. in the years prior to the Civil War. In his latest book, Walter Johnson explores the entire fraught history of race and class in America through the lens of one American city, St. Louis, Missouri. The birthplace of Black Lives Matter in the 21st century was also the hometown of the Dred Scott Supreme Court decision in the lead-up to the Civil War, and the headquarters for the American military's campaigns against the indigenous peoples in the Americas. Add in the systematic use of urban renewal to displace historic black communities, a textbook case of white flight that hollowed out the city's core to this day, and a race massacre every bit as deadly and destructive as the one in Tulsa, just across the river in East St. Louis, and you have American race relations in microcosm. Walter Johnson is a professor of history and professor of African and African-American studies at Harvard University. The Columbia, Missouri native offers a critical eye to his home state in his new book, The Broken Heart of America, St. Louis and the Violent History of the United States. It's published by Basic Books, and he joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Johnson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Your book, The Broken Heart of America, is a fascinating look at one city and telling a larger story about America. You wrote this book, you said you began in the days after Michael Brown's shooting death in Ferguson, but it, of course, tells a far larger story about America and what you call the history of racial capitalism. What do you mean by racial capitalism?
I think the idea there is that since the era of the slave trade, that the history of capitalism and the history of ideas about racial difference and ideas about racial superiority, Anglo-Saxon or white supremacy, have been entwined. And that's not a simple story. It's a complicated story. It's a complicated story over many, many changes in economic life and many, many changes in the ways that African Americans or Native Americans are seen and controlled. And so what I try to do in the book is trace through 8 or 10 different versions of that relationship, starting with the sort of frontier exchange imperial economy of Lewis and Clark and going all the way up to 21st century Ferguson, where I argue that there's a sort of a last round of extraction occurring where African Americans in St. Louis who have been rendered surplus, whose labor is no longer essential to the city of St. Louis, are being rendered up for for-profit policing and payday loans and mass incarceration. So that's the final round, the final sort of formation of racial capitalism in the book. But in between, there's you know, as I say, 7 or 8 different sorts of moments where I try to map the relationship between imperialism, capitalism, and racism.
You write that St. Louis is perhaps the one city that tells this American story that's repeated in many other cities better than most. And as you alluded in your last answer, you know, it begins with Lewis and Clark deciding to discover the West, air quote, discover the West, through the launch of Black Lives Matter. Why is St. Louis the best place to tell this story than perhaps anywhere else?
Yeah, I was struck, you know, I mean, I resisted writing a book about St. Louis for a long time. I mean, I feel like I've been resisting this book for, you know, 10 or 15 years where I've been telling graduate students, oh man, you should write about St. Louis. St. Louis is really interesting, but not doing it myself because of some set of very complicated factors about the idea of going home or writing about home. But eventually, you know, it sort of dawned on me as I started to think about St. Louis and the aftermath of Michael Brown that many of the things that we think about as American history, whether that's the Missouri Compromise or the Dred Scott decision or the first general emancipation in the United States or the first really successful general strike in the United States, some of the big Supreme Court cases of the 20th century, including Shelley versus Kramer, which is an absolutely central housing rights case. Many of these things happen in St. Louis, all the way up to Ferguson. And so why? And the thing that struck me as I tried to answer that question was really the juncture of imperialism. St. Louis was the hub of the 19th century Western Empire. It was the headquarters of the Western Department of the United States Army, and it was the staging ground for many of the Indian Wars, most of those that occurred in the West, and anti-blackness. And so trying to think about those two things together throughout the book is really where it gets its energy.
Of course, that first story you tell, the first story of racial conflict is not between black and white. It's between Native indigenous people and whites. And you begin by telling the story of William Clark, who left from St. Louis to discover that West with Meriwether Lewis, then returned to supervise the country's affairs with Indians in that department of the West. I'm not sure it was actually called that at the very beginning, but he certainly was the person that supervised America's ongoing conflicts with Indians during the first half of the 19th century. And that is the first story. This first story of this city's troubled history of racial justice begins with Native Americans and Americans.
Right. Yeah, so he was the superintendent of Indian affairs beginning in maybe 1816 and all the way through the 1830s. And that meant that Clark was the person who presided over the first round of Indian removal in the United States, which was the removal of the tribes of the upper Midwest. And he was still the superintendent of Indian affairs, you know, when Andrew Jackson became the president through the period of the Indian Removal Act of 1830 and on. The thing that struck me about Clark, and I'm not the first to have noticed this, is that he was someone whose fame and whose early career were really dependent upon the good graces of Native American people. So when Clark and Lewis, when Lewis and Clark, more familiarly, set out on the Missouri River, they were strangers in a strange land. They didn't know where they were going, and they didn't really have the tools to get there. And so particularly for the first winter, the winter of 1804, they were really dependent upon the good graces of the Mandan people for their survival. And so I think the emblematic irony is too weak a word to describe it, but Clark is someone like the city of St. Louis itself, whose early rise was predicated upon a very, very complicated and very fraught set of relationships with Native Americans around trade that were then, in the years after 1816, really, subordinated to an ever more murderous vision of American and white supremacist empire in the West.
And he's the first story you tell in a series of really interesting stories about some of these people, many of them lost to the names lost to history, like the Thomas Hart Benton you write about is not the painter from the 20th century. It's
right.
The senator, land baron, the agent of the Shoto family, which we know here in Oklahoma to this day, you know, who basically was providing a lot of the rhetoric of building empire to the West.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, Benton, I think, is one of the first people in American history in the 1820s, as early as the 1820s, to start talking about building a Pacific empire. And he remains obsessed with Western empire and the notion of a transcontinental connection, eventually a transcontinental railroad through his entire political career up through the 1850s. He also is, although he is, as you point out, continually doing the bidding of his plutocratic patrons, the Choteaus. He is also representing himself to be, and to some degree actually is, the champion of Westering small holding or non-land holding working class poor whites. And so it's Benton more than anyone else, including Andrew Jackson, in the 30s and 40s, who really tries to champion the notion of giving away the public domain of the United States to poor white people. it must be said, and the book says it over and over again, that the public domain of the United States of America in the 1830s and 1840s is expropriated Indian land. It is the product of ethnic cleansing. And so what Benton is doing is converting empire into the materiality of white supremacy, right? He's taking Indian land and turning it into ground upon which white families can live. And so it is his vision, I argue, more than any other, that shapes the trajectory of the city of St. Louis through the 19th century. It shapes the idea of the West, most, you know, that is broadcast from St. Louis as a white man's country. And the vision of the white man's country depends upon Indian removal and black exclusion.
And that becomes a sort of an underlying ground for the country's development for centuries later, because that sort of feeling of white powerlessness, and again, using racial hatred and racial stoking, I guess, if you will, as a device, starts becoming evident at that point as well.
Yeah, I think that's a theme that runs through the book, just as I think it is a theme that runs through American history. And so one of the great models for the book is W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American historian W.E.B. Du Bois, who is, I think, thinks very, very powerfully about the relationship of class relations between white people and white supremacy. And more often than not, the way that powerful white people manipulate notions of racial difference to pit white and black working people against one another. And so, as well as Benton, you know, there's the standout example of the East St. Louis race massacre in 1917, which is one of the, again, it's another one of these sort of emblematic American events that happened in St. Louis.
My guest today is Walter Johnson. He's a professor of history and professor of African and African American studies at Harvard University. And his latest book is titled The Broken Heart of America, St. Louis and the Violent History of the United States. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa, where he tells this story of a large history of racial history and racial capitalism through one city, that of St. Louis. Before we get to the East St. Louis race massacre, because I do want to talk about that, you tell an interesting story at the opening chapters of St. Louis's racial history between black and whites, and it goes along with the Dred Scott decision, which again came from St. Louis, plays a big role. And was struck by something you wrote. It says, it's interesting that it should come from St. Louis, a city where slavery played a marginal role in the economy. The deeper truth is that slavery in St. Louis was uniquely precarious, and because it was uniquely precarious, it was uniquely violent. How much does that explain about St. Louis's racial history?
I think what I'm trying to say there is, and this comes on the heels of having written two books about the history of slavery in the Deep South, is that part of, if you think about slavery as a state of constant conflict, part of that conflict in the South is determined by or shaped by the landscape and the distance from safety for enslaved people. And so, you know, the options for somebody in Mississippi or Louisiana around the question of escape are very, very few. In St. Louis, that's different. In St. Louis, Illinois is right across the river, and there are, in fact, abolitionist slave raiders coming across from Illinois and helping enslaved people escape all the time. And there are pro-slavery kidnappers going into Illinois and taking free black people and selling them into slavery. And so that is, there's a state of, I think, really open warfare on that border in the 1840s. And again, this is something that I think is probably not as well known as it should be. There is good work on it, but it's terrifically interesting. The thing that really struck me about the Dred Scott case is the extent to which, number one, it was framed that there's a lot of language about a fear of race war that surrounds the Dred Scott case. And much of that is associated with a kind of a fear of free people of color. And so we think about the Dred Scott case as a pro-slavery decision in the history of the emerging conflict between North and South. And it surely is that. But what struck me that I don't think people have talked about perhaps as much as they could is the fact that it is also a case which is very, very strongly and explicitly about the regulation and extraterritorialization of free people of color. It's basically about getting rid of free people of color. The statement, "No rights which the white man is bound to respect," is a way of reducing free people of color to the condition of slaves. And that seems to me, I argue, to be evidence of the notion of the white man's country, and the white man's country as distinct from the empire of slavery, a white man's country in which land was reserved for working class and small-holding white people, non-slave-holding white people, over and against slaveholders and free people of color. And that's the sort of Bentonite version that I think explains much of the politics of not just St. Louis or not even the state of Missouri, but actually the Republican Party on the eve of the Civil War.
You also tell stories of St. Louis with people who don't buy into that narrative and with other bitter divides in class and social outlook at the same time as this history of black-white relations are taking back. You're seeing a big break in relations in class, and the city does provide the first general emancipation during the Civil War. After the war, the first general strike in the United States in 1877, it was a hotbed of radicalism. You tell a story of the generals that sort of led to the first emancipation. They were actually communists. They were followers of Marx.
That's right. So
how does this fit into the narrative?
Well, so this is something that I guess that surprised and, I hate to say it out loud, but it really gratified me. I mean, being a Missourian, right, and being on the left politically, I found a very, very deep vein of radical history in the history of St. Louis. And one of the places that begins is with German emigres after the European revolutions of 1848. St. Louis has always been, and still to some degree is, a very German city. And so it's one of the centers to which these people, along with Milwaukee and certainly along with New York City and several other cities, to which people migrate. And so all of a sudden, you find that Franz Siegel, who was probably the most famous German-American in the 19th century before the emergence of Carl Schurz, another figure in the book, was what I describe a stone-cold communist. I mean, he was really somebody who thought long before Lincoln, long before the United States of America, that the Civil War should be a war against slavery, not a war to preserve the Union. And you find Joseph Weidemeyer, who was a close friend of both Marx and Engels, a continual correspondent of Marx and Engels, and the publisher and translator of some of Marx's most important work, is the Union Army colonel who organized the artillery defense of the city of St. Louis. And so, tracing then the influence of that strain of thought, which did produce the first general emancipation order in the United States during the Civil War, which Abraham Lincoln then promptly countermanded, was fun. It was interesting to me. And those are not the forces that eventually take control of Missouri or the United States after the Civil War, but they certainly shaped the history in between. The alliance between African-American escaping slaves and these radicals is one of the most interesting moments in the history of St. Louis. And then that it follows through certainly the politics of the 1870s. There's a lot of tumult in the 1870s, but there's a moment in 1877, in accordance with various strikes breaking out across the nation on the railroads, where the workers in St. Louis rise up and shut the city down in a general strike. And there are explicit moments during that strike when black workers get up and make speeches and say, they basically say, "And all the things you just said, do they apply to me as well?" And the crowds, say yes and affirm the solidarity with black workers. And there's a moment then when the workers' collective in St. Louis is actually making production decisions, deciding whether or not factories can reopen, how much bread can be produced, this sort of thing, a very brief moment. It quickly falls apart. It falls apart under the threat of federal military action, and because of armed militias in St. Louis, but also because the solidarity between the white and black workers is, I think, undermined by the leadership of the strike. It's a story that is both incredible and interesting and inspiring. It's also a story of those things which ultimately did not happen.
Well, as you alluded to earlier, you tell the story of the East St. Louis Massacre of 1917, the first of a series of race massacres that occurred throughout the country, that it culminated in Tulsa here in 1921.
Right.
While it's interesting, some of the issues that started the massacre might be a little different, the underlying heart of the issues at St. Louis, like in Tulsa, seem strikingly familiar and similar. What do we need to know about this particular massacre?
I think the first thing to know, and this is something that people have written a good deal about, is the way that black migrants from the South who were leaving untenable, unlivable, inhumane conditions in the South and making their way to cities like Chicago or to St. Louis or to Tulsa were being employed by the industrial overlords of places like East St. Louis as a sort of a reserve army of labor. And that's to say that the conditions of their employment remained segregated, and they were mostly barred from employment and kept unemployed or underemployed until those managers and owners needed them to come in and replace striking white workers. And so they were pitted against the white workers in a way that was ultimately disastrous. Du Bois sort of fantastically says at some point that among the failures of the labor movement in the end of the 19th century was its failure to recognize that 4 million emancipated slaves should have been organized, right? Mm. So organized labor in the United States is, in the late 19th century, by and large, hostile to African Americans all the way through the First World War. And, you know, some could argue up to the present day in some manifestations. And so what happens there is that there's a strike in the aluminum ore plant, and the owners and managers bring in black replacement workers who are protected by federal troops. This is 1917. It's during the First World War. We might imagine that the deployment of the National Guard to protect black workers is, let's say, triggering to ethnic whites whose loyalty to the United States has, in many cases, in Illinois, been called into question already. And so that kind of cauldron of economic exploitation and racial animosity and then questions about patriotism and alignment explodes. That's the story we know. I think the story that's been underemphasized is that it explodes in a way that is as much targeted at black neighborhoods in East St. Louis as it is at black working men. And so what I argue is that the attacks on the neighborhoods were literally thousands of people, 3,000 or 4,000, maybe 5,000 people, are driven away from East St. Louis, their homes are burned, and they never return to the city. I argue that that's part of a history of removal that characterizes the argument of the book, you know, that characterizes the history of St. Louis.
That's true.
And that's the story, and that's really why I employ the language of massacre, which is what Du Bois employed when he went to East St. Louis in the aftermath. It's what Ida B. Wells employed when she went to East St. Louis in the aftermath. And it was, I think, a tremendous driving out.
When you travel to St. Louis today, I think anyone can be struck by the obvious signs of urban renewal. If you've ever driven west out of downtown, you'll come upon this strange area with little development. It's the old Mill Valley neighborhood. Still to this day, its areas are barren, and in other parts, they don't look like the rest of St. Louis of this time.
No, no.
You're struck by chains across streets, concrete planters to wall off affluent neighborhoods. And you tell this story, and I was sort of alluded to this, you know, when blacks stood up for their rights in the mid-20th century, whites basically didn't fight back. They just left for the most part.
Right.
And
right.
And this urban renewal, at the same time, they're raising black neighborhoods. Harlan Bartholomew, a name probably lost to history perhaps outside of St. Louis. This is a person that had tremendous impact on black neighborhoods and the shape of the city today.
That's right. I should have looked up before we talked to see whether or not Bartholomew had worked in Tulsa. But Bartholomew did urban planning work in maybe 150, 200 American cities. And it was really he, as much as anyone else in the history of the United States, who designed the template of interstate highways serving suburbs. And so I think that's right, that in the beginning, in the late 40s and all the way through the 70s and 80s, that rather than fighting a block-by-block war about integration, whites in St. Louis simply moved to St. Louis County and established, you know, famously 90-some municipalities, many of them established around zoning codes. And this is a Bartholomew tool. Bartholomew was one of the inventors of city zoning in the history of the United States, zoning codes that were designed to exclude poor working class African Americans and, by extension, poor and working class white people. So, you know, minimum lot size is a perfect example. You have a city in St. Louis that'll have a minimum lot size of you know, a third or a half of an acre. So you can only live there if you have a huge yard. Well, you can only have a huge yard if you have a lot of money. So the story of the 20th century, I do try to really locate at the junction of real estate capitalism and racism, and follow it through both the tearing down for real estate speculative reasons of Mill Creek Valley, the neighborhood that you were talking about, which was almost 500 acres. 20,000 people live there, 800 sort of civic and business institutions there. And the city tore it down in 1959 and basically put nothing in its place. It is still, as you say, it's still a kind of a open, sort of semi-industrial but hugely underutilized space in the city. And that's, you know, the story of much of St. Louis. Bartholomew at some point posted a plan, you know, put together a master comprehensive plan for the city in 1948 that recommended the demolition of, I think it was, 20,000 square acres, you know, and so they didn't get there, right? but there was still a massive urban redevelopment. And the historian Clarence Lang, who's one of the many wonderful historians who's worked on the history of St. Louis, said while the South had massive resistance, people pulling their kids out of public schools and putting them into private schools, the Midwest had massive redevelopment, simply tearing down neighborhoods.
Well, if you go to the Arch, that was formerly a warehouse and black district. You go to the Edward Jones Dome downtown, a black district, a black neighborhood. Yeah, all of these.
All those things are built in, you know, built on famous black neighborhoods, right? I mean, you could argue that the Edward Jones Dome is, some of it is built over the neighborhood where ragtime music was pioneered and where many of the folk songs, Frankie and Johnny, or Stagalee for your Grateful Dead listeners in the audience, where, you know, that's where Stagalee, the actual human being, you know, lived and shot a man over a Stetson hat.
Professor Johnson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Harvard University historian Walter Johnson is the author of The Broken Heart of America, St. Louis and the Violent History of the United States. It's published by Basic Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.